Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Senators John Kerry and Joe Lieberman introduced legislation yesterday aimed at ending U.S. dependence on foreign energy sources. The American Power Act includes caps on greenhouse gas emissions and promotes domestic energy production. But the massive Gulf Coast oil spill and the decision by GOP Senator Lindsey Graham to withdraw his support raises questions about the bill's future. Joining me in the studio to talk about the BP catastrophe and the future of offshore drilling, Joe Rome with the Center for American Progress, The Wall Street Journal's Neil King, and Scott Siegel with the law firm Bracewell and Giuliani. He represents utilities, refineries, and manufacturers. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Joining us now from the Times-Picayune offices in New Orleans is environment reporter Mark Schlepstein. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning.
Talk about the latest efforts to plug the leak. What's going on?
Well, they're now considering two alternatives. They have a smaller containment box called a top hat on the seafloor on standby. While they're testing a cracked riser pipe, this is the pipe that used to be connected to the surface that a bunch of other pipes were through and that the oil is actually leaking out of, that is now lying on the sea floor. They're considering just sticking another pipe with a rubber seal on its end into the crack that is in that riser pipe where the main leak is of oil is coming out, and then just sipping the oil out of there and pushing it directly to the surface. The tests are designed to determine whether there are any structural problems with that downed riser pipe that might make that strategy dangerous. In other words, whether putting the new pipe in could increase the pressure and make the old riser fail. If that doesn't work, they'll go ahead and move that top hat, which is a smaller box, over the leak. And that top hat will already be connected to the surface with piping, and they'll have warmer water from the surface and methanol, basically a form of alcohol, that will be sprayed into the opening to keep natural gas from turning into hydrates inside the box.
There's been talk about shredded tires, golf balls, similar objects, shooting debris into this leak. Describe what that would do and how in the world it might work.
Okay, well, basically that's strategy number three, okay? And what they would do with that is that they would find a way of shoving that material, pieces of different sizes of junk, basically, and they call it a junk shot, directly into the hole in the blowout preventer through which the oil is leaking. And the idea of that is if you stuff all that down there, all those different little pieces and everything might catch together and clog it up, you know, like a clogged toilet, to the point where they would then be able to connect another pipe to the blowout preventer and put heavier drilling mud in and then control the well that way. It's a more complicated process, and it's still unclear whether or not it'll work.
It really sounds bizarre, but I am assuming that these people at least think they know what they're doing. What about the contamination efforts, the efforts to slow the spread onto the shores?
Well, what's happening right now, there already are about 500 boats that are out there of various sizes and types that are responding to the spill. And most of them are involved in attempts to corral the oil into small little batches where it can be either skimmed from the surface or burned off. Burning has been delayed out there for, rarely used, unfortunately, because of the wind speeds that are on the surface. They're hoping to get a burn or two done today. That actually works probably the quickest, although, you have to make sure that when the stuff is burning that the wind is blowing in the right direction. And they're also continuing to do flights by airplane and helicopter, spraying dispersants over the oil to make it break up into tiny little droplets and drop down to the floor of the ocean.
Mark, we've heard lots about kicks and how they might have caused the accident. What are the kicks?
Well, basically, it's puffs of gas from down below. As you're drilling a well down through from the surface down into the actual deposit, the area underground where the oil and gas is stored in some sort of rock formation, you might actually hit other layers where there might be some natural gas in a separate formation. And when it happens, you can have a kick of that gas, basically a release of that gas that will pop up through the drilling and through that casing into to the surface. And if that happens, you have to increase the strength of the mud, the heaviness of the mud, to keep it under control so that the stuff doesn't come to the surface. What we in the New York Times both reported was that there was a kick of mud a couple of weeks prior to the accident that was strong enough that it actually did get to the surface to the point where they actually had to shut down the rig for a while until they got it back under control.
And finally, what do you see the coastal states doing about this spill?
Well, I can tell you in Louisiana, they are attempting everything all at once. They're continuing to push hard on BP and federal officials to release more boom to capture the oil before it comes ashore. They're urging approval of a new strategy to dredge sediment from a mile offshore of some of the state's barrier islands, and use that to build extensions of those islands to capture the oil before it moves into the wetlands behind them. Mm. A bunch of different things. And they're also working hard to get aid both from BP and from the federal government for the fishermen and other people who've been put out of work by this.
So how do you compare what the government has done here to what it did in response to, for example, Hurricane Katrina?
It's really difficult to compare the two disasters. I mean, Katrina was so overwhelming and so broad, and it was so much more people oriented. I mean, it affected people's lives immediately. The response to that was very difficult at the very beginning, and really the problem there was that they weren't prepared for it in advance. With this one, this is a much more slow-moving kind of a disaster. They've had time to gear up, and it's also clear that the Obama administration is working overtime to fight back against the perception that they're not engaged, as can be seen by this steady stream of cabinet-level officials through Louisiana and other coastal states in the last couple of days. Again, it's really hard to make a comparison in terms of the responses to these two things because of that.
Mark Schlepstein, he's environment reporter for the Times-Picayune and co-author of Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans, The Coming Age of Superstorms. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Let me turn to you now, Neil King, and get you to talk about what we learned from the House hearings yesterday about this whole disaster.
Yeah, one thing I think is worth pointing out at the very beginning is that this has all happened against this backdrop of a sort of perceived infallibility, where just 3 weeks before this explosion, President Obama unveiled his offshore plan and expansion. He talked about how the technology was so extraordinary, there was very little risk involved. And even after it happened, there was this sense of this was sort of the ultimate black swan. It comes along, it's such an extraordinary rarity. How could anybody have ever predicted it? You know, it couldn't really be BP's fault per se because they had such a good track record, et cetera. I think what we really learned yesterday was that just to what extent they're operating in a zone of extraordinary risk and to the extent that there were flaws up and down the chain. I mean, there was, you know, a lot of people have talked about how there was a lot of finger pointing among the companies, but in some ways that's justified because we're increasingly learning that all of them botched up in various ways. It seems very clear that Halliburton, which is the Houston-based company responsible for the cement work, did that in some sort of shoddy way. We're only figuring out kind of how that was the case. That Transocean, which is the primary owner of the blowout preventer, had modified this preventer over the years, that there were various flaws in it, that it was leaking hydraulic fluid, that there was a battery that was evidently dead. And of course, foremost, the company primarily in charge, BP, showed just bad judgment along a number of cases, particularly in the day of the explosion when there were tests coming back, when they were doing some key procedures that were showing that the pressure was all over the place. And yet they decided at about 5 o'clock on the afternoon that this thing blew up to go move forward. And the whole thing went up in flames 4 hours later.
Neil King, he's national reporter for the Wall Street Journal. When we come back, you'll hear from Joe Rome and Scott Siegel. We'll take your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. As we talk about the oil spill in the Gulf, I have three guests here in the studio with me. Neil King of the Wall Street Journal, Joe Rome of the Center for American Progress. Scott Siegel is with Bracewell and Giuliani, a law firm that represents utilities, refiners, and manufacturers. You can join us. 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. Let me turn to you, Scott Siegel. Here is an email from Tina in Falls Church. She says, I watched the hearings over the last 2 days. I have a question. Was this well in production for a while, or was it a new well in the process of being completed?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I don't represent BP and Transocean. In fact, I'm happy to report that I don't represent anybody in the direct chain of events that occurred here, although we've been watching it very closely. I will say this. The Deepwater Horizon is what's called a mobile offshore drilling unit, or MODU. And the way things typically work is you take your seismic readings to understand where the good play might be. then you take your MODU out, and it actually does the drilling, exploration and drilling. And then once the well is producing, the MODU leaves because it is capable of being self-propelled, actually is crewed like a ship. It leaves, and what is put in its place is a floating platform, which is then tethered. So where we were on this particular oil play is at the point at which the MODU is still doing the drilling, still in the developmental phase, and then when it leaves, there would have been production through a production platform that would have then attached to pipelines and got the oil to market in that way.
Neil, do you want to add?
Yeah,
to that?
I was just going
to
say they were in the really literally the final days of finishing this. They were going to seal it off and come back later for the production. And one of the big questions that's out there was, were they cutting corners essentially, and were they, those things cost $500,000 a day to stay there. And basically, if it is the case that they had shoddy cementing, to go back and do it over again would have cost them at least 2 weeks. And you can do the math. That's a lot of money. So there's one of the questions out there is, did they in the end say, you know what, let's finish it, seal it off, which was another day or two, move this thing on, and we'll come back to it later. And if that was the big gamble right there.
Joe wrote that blame game, as Neil King talked about, has been going on now for quite a while. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, the industry told us that this couldn't happen, and they insisted and got, in the Bush years, a voluntary self-certification, you know, trust us approach.
Self-certification.
Self-certification. This was a point that the Coast Guard captain made yesterday, that the blowout preventer, for instance, was manufactured by industry, installed by industry, with no government witnessing oversight or installation of construction. And another, I think, rather shocking thing yesterday we learned was that the Deepwater Horizon rig used the Marshall Islands flag as a flag of convenience so it could comply with that country's standards and not U.S. regulations. So I think what we have learned is that we can't really believe what the industry is telling us. We're going to need much tougher regulations if we're going to prevent this from happening again.
Scott Siegel, were the regulations different in the Clinton administration than they were in the Bush administration?
No, not in any appreciable way. And I did want to address one thing that Joe just said about the Republic of the Marshall Islands being the flag for the vessel. That's true enough, and there's going to be a lot of oversight, I suspect, over the policing of that flag. But the one thing you do need to know is the Republic of the Marshall Islands and all the other flags that authorize and inspect and permit these facilities to proceed are signatories to something called the International Maritime Organization, which has the same rules. There's a uniformity of rules across flags. That isn't to say that they have the same resources and all the rest of it, but they do have the same rules. So to say that they went to the Republic of Marshall Islands to avoid substantive rules being put in place, that's not actually accurate. Look, the events in the Gulf are terrible. They're tragic. And there's going to be a big change in the way oil and gas is produced, particularly in deep water.
Neil, tell me about the pressure test that Deepwater Horizon well did not pass.
Well, there were discrepancies, basically. They were doing what they're called positive and negative tests that were basically, is like, okay, we've put this concrete seal around the well casing that went down 13,000 feet, particularly at the portion where it actually comes to where the oil is, and is this thing sound? And they were getting readings that there was influx of gas and other hydrocarbons into the bottom of the wellbore that were disturbing, and this came up very prominently at the hearing yesterday, and both the CEO of Transocean and the main BP official were saying, yeah, this is sort of the heart of the matter, that there were these anomalous, somewhat disturbing readings in the afternoon of the 20th of April. All the same, they decided to go forward with what was removing what they call mud, which is this very heavy drilling fluid, which keeps the pressure intact from the oil, which is wanting to come out. And they were subbing that out, really starting that night, I think after sundown, and starting to replace it with seawater, which I think is like 10 times as light. And it was not enough weight. In the end, the stuff just shot up through, and all the readings are there as to when that happened, and then all hell broke loose.
And then Congressman Bart Stupak said that there were just significant problems discovered with this blowout preventer, Joe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think people should understand that the blowout preventer clearly, I mean, he said it had like a how can a device that has 260 failure modes be considered fail-safe? I think people need to understand that nearly all of the blowouts examined by a 2007 Minerals Management Service report were in the Gulf of Mexico. We clearly are doing something very different in the Gulf of Mexico than we're doing elsewhere.
What do you mean?
Well, they did a major study, and they found if you look at where blowouts occur around the world, much more accidents are occurring in the Gulf of Mexico.
Why should that be?
Again, well, certainly in Europe, they have tougher regulations. Other countries require more fail-safe systems. The fact is Brazil and Norway require a $500,000 acoustic backup system for the blowout preventer. And we learned yesterday that it's possible that that might have helped prevent the system disaster.
Why doesn't BP have that same system?
Well, they insisted, they fought efforts by the Minerals Management System during the previous administration to make it mandatory. They said, you don't need it, it's superfluous. And I think the fact of the matter is that if you listen to the hearings over the last 2 days with all the industries pointing fingers at one another, we need something like a Challenger Commission to find out what happened. Remember, after the two space shuttles blew up, we stopped putting up space shuttles until we figured out exactly what happened. We need an independent commission that is going to investigate all the data, talk to everyone involved, and figure out what happened, certainly before we put in any new deep water drilling like
this.
How
likely is that, Scott?
Oh, I think there is no shortage of independent investigations going on at this point. We have one inquiry that's going on down in New Orleans through the Coast Guard. We have another inquiry that's going on, obviously, in Washington. We've had 7 or 8 different public hearings now noticed. So there'll be a lot of sunshine put on it. But I do want to say one thing. What Joe just said reminds me a lot of the rhetoric we heard after Three Mile Island in 1979. The result of that is 3 decades of no United States leadership in nuclear power at a very time when we could have used that source of power as a source of energy diversity in a low-carbon or carbon-constrained future. I would hate to think that, you know, we have natural gas resources, that the bill that was, well, that we'll talk about in a moment, is relying upon for a clean energy future. I would hate to think that overreaction to the extraordinary events that occurred in the Gulf would result in 30 years of failure to produce U.S. domestic, defendable, secure supplies of hydrocarbons. That would be a horrible mistake along the same lines as the mistakes made after Three Mile Island.
What do you think, Neil?
I agree with Joe's point that we really have to reassess this and look really strongly at what we've done wrong. I also agree in part with what Scott's just said. I mean, there's a very serious domestic issue at play here, and I think one thing has been interesting is that in Congress there has been really kind of it's almost sort of a tepid reaction in that regard. I mean, I think there's this realization across both parties really that we've got to forge ahead on exploration in the Gulf. The Journal actually had a poll that came out yesterday that was across the spectrum of politics and everything, but it had some interesting findings on this question. 60% of the people said they supported continued drilling. Only 22% said they strongly opposed it. And amazing, 53%, even in the wake of this spill, said that they thought the benefits of continued drilling outweighed the potential environmental harm, which is rather amazing, despite the poll also finding this extraordinary concern altogether. It's overwhelmingly the biggest thing going on now among the American public in terms of what, you know, has seized their imagination more than, you know, any of this terrorism stuff or any of the other things.
So now we have the Kerry Lieberman bill. What would that mean for offshore drilling, Joe?
Well, they revised the bill. The Kerry Lieberman bill is the American Power Act. It is designed to put a penalty on pollution and promote clean energy and put us on the transition to getting off of fossil fuels and reducing carbon pollution and reducing oil consumption, which I think is a long-term strategy. Originally, it had, I think, fairly open drilling require it was going to open a lot of area to drilling. In the light of the disaster, what they did was said, we're going to allow studies to be done of any new drilling, and any state that is turns out is going to be affected by a new drilling can veto it. So I think that I think one of the outcomes of this disaster is that a lot of states are going to reevaluate whether the risks and benefits pay out.
So that what you're saying and what the bill is proposing is that states have the option to say they don't want offshore drilling?
Correct. And under the way the bill is written, It is likely to play out that even neighboring states, originally it was only going to be, let's say, Virginia that could veto drilling off of Virginia. But now it might well turn out that, let's say, New Jersey could veto drilling off of Virginia if it turns out, based on a study, that a major spill off of Virginia could impact New Jersey.
Nail.
This whole thing to me just gets at what I consider to be kind of our national hypocrisy on this whole issue. I mean, if you look at the states that are in question, California, Florida, all the northeast coastal states, that's where the people live, that's where the cars are driven, and that's where the energy consumption is, overwhelmingly. So basically what the message is our shores are too hallowed for this kind of thing, and we'll basically let offshore Africa. Most of our imported oil comes from Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, and offshore of other people's countries. Offshore Venezuela, offshore Brazil, offshore Angola, etc. So basically it's Americans saying, we love our shores, we'll import other people's offshore oil. And it just gets to the core of what our energy identity is.
Neil King of the Wall Street Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's a message from Facebook from Chris, who says this accident is exactly why we should stop drilling completely and switch to wind power. Have you ever heard of an offshore wind turbine causing such a mess, Scott?
Boy, what a target-rich environment that question is, because there's so many things going on. First of all, oftentimes in the environmental community, no good deed goes unpunished. And so did you follow the open warfare that occurred over building Cape Wind? So even when you try and build, that's the large wind farm off of Cape Cod. You know, when you try and build a state-of-the-art wind facility, you get the same kind of permitting, not in my backyard type of issues. That's one problem. The second is that, you know, our cars, for better or for worse, don't run on wind power or the production of wind power, which is electricity. At some point, we will have more electric cars, there's no doubt. But we have to think of fuels for transportation in terms of bridge fuels. We're not there yet. And frankly, crude petroleum is incredibly rich and dense in energy. We're going to rely on crude petroleum for quite a while. If we don't produce crude petroleum in, say, the Gulf of Mexico, for example, and we rely, as Neil was suggesting, more on a country like Nigeria, it might be interesting for listeners to know that every year since 1969, Nigeria has had a major oil spill, what by the United States would be an intolerable oil spill, a major oil spill every year since 69. So does it make sense for us to rely more on countries like that and import that oil to truly, as Neil was suggesting, export the problem overseas? I don't think so.
Joe, how do you respond?
Well, we are one of the points of the American Power Act that Karen Lieberman introduced was to begin the transition to electrifying the transportation system. So, and I don't think there's any question that the future, we're not making more oil. And everyone knows the price of gasoline is going to keep going up. And we're sending $1 billion a day overseas to buy foreign oil right now. Now, we only have, quite literally, 2% of the world's oil reserves, but we have 25% of the world's oil consumption. So we have to get off of oil. Even President Bush said we were addicted to oil. So we have to end that addiction, and that means fuel efficiency in cars, and it means transitioning to electrifying the vehicle system. So I'm a big believer in offshore wind. And I will say, you know, I spent a lot of time on my blog, Climate Progress, going into what the solutions are. We can't get off of oil tomorrow. But we need, you know, tougher regulations on the industry today and then a transition to get off these fuels starting as soon as possible.
Now, tell me about the Minerals Management Service. I understand it's going to be split into two. Neil, explain why.
Minerals Management Service is an outfit within the Department of Interior that has about 1,700 people. The overwhelming majority of them do leasing, they bring in royalties, they do permitting, and they don't really do a lot of oversight, as Joe was saying. Most of these other countries, particularly in Europe, I should say, that have a lot of offshore exploration and an offshore industry have long ago split their equivalent of the MMS, as we call it, so that there are watchdogs and there are revenue collectors. The MMS, interestingly, brings in more revenue than any other agency within the government except for the Department of Treasury. I think they brought in something like $14 billion or something like that last year in royalties for this kind of action. What proposal was put forward the other day by Interior Secretary Salazar and obviously endorsed by the White House was to separate the thing. They would have about 300 people in the watchdog side, and they would rev up the number of inspectors. They're now, I think, about 60. I think they want there to be something like twice that many, put, you know, $30 million more into the thing and give it some teeth. So that's sort of the basic
How
idea.
How much do you think that would help?
I think it would make a big difference. I don't know whether just the separating itself is a thing, but I think it's I think that's important to do that, if only cosmetically. And I think to give this agency some real policing powers and to make it more of an actual regulator as opposed to the kind of self-regulating sort of thing that exists now.
Scott.
My view of it is this. This division of MMS is going to occur, and I think for a variety of reasons it makes some sense. However, I don't think we should kid ourselves about the comprehensiveness of this solution only in this respect. You can go government agency by government agency and see lots of this kind of contradiction. FDA, best example, they're supposed to move new drugs to market and they're supposed to regulate drug safety. You could literally find that kind of discontinuity in almost every government agency.
Scott Siegel, Bracewell Giuliani, we'll take a short break. When we come back, time for your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Tarcher Penguin, with Jeremy Rifkin's new book, The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, in stores and online. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
65 million Americans are caring for an ailing parent or spouse. Best-selling author Gail Sheehy talks about coping with this challenge in her own life and finding support. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And BP has released a 30-second film of the leak in the Gulf. We've got that on our website, drshow.org. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Garland, Texas. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Yes. It seems like all the attempts to seal off this well are trying to salvage the well. I'm trying to figure out why they don't just blow it up.
Neil King.
Blowing it up is actually the thing that they're most worried about. This whole idea of doing this junk shot, as we talked about at the beginning of the hour, which is basically there's this huge blowout preventer. It's like 55 feet high. It's where all oil has to pass through. It didn't obviously do its prevention work. So they're now talking about just filling it with junk of all kinds. And the one concern they had there is whether this thing, under all the pressure that it's gone through, might have cracked in some fashion or become weakened, so that by shooting this stuff in it, they could essentially do, as the caller is saying, blow it up. And if they were to blow it up, we could have what would be the natural flow of oil from this well, which they've said themselves, BP, would be 50 or 60,000 barrels a day, which would be maybe.
For how long? That's what everybody wants to know. How long could this last?
Well, the one certain fix to this is going to be these relief wells, which they're now starting to drill one. They're going to start over the weekend to drill another. It's basically starting all over from what they did in the beginning and drilling down all the way 18,000 feet from the sea, the surface of the Gulf, and plugging this thing up at the base. And that will take 3 months from about 2 weeks ago. So we're talking about 70 days or something like
And that. And that is, Diane, how they cured the issue that occurred in the Timor Sea up north of New Guinea. Same deal. They had a blow, and then they drilled these relief wells to relieve the pressure. The problem is that the formation is under a tremendous amount of pressure. I mean, this is somewhat characteristic of deep water formations. And so if you tried to blow it up, you could have a much worse leak.
You know, there've got to be a lot of people wondering how this oil leak could affect the oceanic plates, how the tectonic plates themselves might move or suddenly be affected by all this, Joe.
Yeah, I'm not certain that this leak can affect the tectonic plates. I will say that what we don't know is the BP is pouring hundreds of thousands of gallons of dispersants so that the oil doesn't hit the shore. And that's a good idea because you can really destroy the shore ecosystems.
But what happens at the bottom of the ocean?
Exactly. What happens is you take the oil into tiny droplets. And oil is very toxic. You know, it's a very toxic thing, as are the dispersants. And you put them in the water column and fish drink them. Oysters get them at the bottom. So while you remove a lot of the environmental impact that people see, you're actually still can potentially devastate the oceans and the ocean bottom.
Scott.
Well, what you're hearing, and I agree, is that there's no really good and tidy solution for any kind of an oil spill. So what's going to happen? What is really going to happen is we're going to see a much tighter regulatory regime come into place. We will see this division of labor within the MMS, but we'll also see new restrictions, new technologies, requirements for inspections, much more mandatory ways of doing business. And that is appropriate. It'll increase
Why
the cost
is
of
it?
Of
I mean,
drilling.
You can look at the banking industry. You can look at the FDA. You can look now at the oil industry and say, why don't these things work, Joe?
Well, I think the analogy is very good to Goldman Sachs. I think what happens is the industry becomes so convinced of its own infallibility that it creates riskier and riskier products, whether it's riskier financial products or, in this case, recklessness or carelessness about these deep water drilling. And I think that you get kind of a circular benchmarking. Since everyone else is doing and nothing bad has happened yet, that must mean nothing bad could happen.
So, Neil, you've got members of Congress on the one hand arguing not my backyard, on the other hand saying you can't put too many regulations on these companies.
Yeah, it is a delicate balance. I mean, they are wanting to give some benefit of the doubt to the industry because they...
Why at this point?
You know, it's one of those things, though, that, you know, again, harking back to what I said at the beginning about President Obama's comments at the end of March, where he was basically saying, you know, let's proceed, overcoming a lot of opposition in his own party and even within his own administration, that, look, the technology is there, the track record is there. I mean, you know, as has been pointed out, on the night of that explosion, they were having a sort of small celebration on that rig to celebrate 7,000 and however many days of no accidents and not one man day lost to an injury. And there was an overall lulled into complacency aspect of the whole thing. And then we find, lo and behold, that below the surface, underneath all this stuff, there was a lot of crazy things going on that make you see something other than infallibility.
Are you disappointed in President Obama's reaction to all this?
Well, I think his reaction to the dealing with the spill has been pretty solid, but I am certainly disappointed that he has not taken the opportunity to really explain to the public that this is one more reason why we need a long-term strategy to get off of the dirty, unsafe fuels of the 19th century and embrace the clean, safe fuels of the 21st century that never run out. And, you know, I think this is a very serious accident. We need to remember that. 11 people died, and this could be one of the greatest environmental disasters of all time. At the same time, the core argument for passing a clean energy legislation is there are a lot of costs of using fossil fuels that we aren't accounting for, and we need to put a penalty on the use of fossil fuels and transition to clean energy.
All right. To Norman, Oklahoma. Good morning, Henry. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. One of my concerns is that what I see here is an appalling lack of technical expertise by British Petroleum. And they're sort of a shotgun approach to trying to solve this problem when we as engineers in this industry have technologies that we know have worked in Kuwait, in the Timor Sea.
Such as, Henry.
Say it again.
Such as. When you say there has been technology that's worked in Kuwait and elsewhere, what are you saying?
Well, this is a flow problem to anybody that knows anything about it. Right now, there are three breaks in the pipeline riser that's on the floor. There's no reason to be fighting three breaks in a pipeline. If they cut that pipeline 20 feet above the blowout preventers with an explosive charge, which can be done in 3 seconds, they'll have a nice clean cut on top of which they can put a hydrill, or it's like a connection that has a pad that can clamp onto it. They'll now have one single point of oil production that they can control. And this idea of having a box or a top hat is so incongruous. A sophomore student in engineering knows that hydrates will form at that pressure and temperature.
Henry, I'm not even a sophomore student, but it doesn't make sense to me either, Neil.
I say send Henry to Houston.
Absolutely.
I mean, he makes a very good point. I think we've all just been kind of mind-boggled and sort of dazzled in a negative sense, if there is such a way, at the primitive ways that they've had to go about this. I mean, they've described the Apollo 13, Apollo 11, all this very stuff, but, you know, it just shows how much they were unprepared for this thing in the first place, or any kind of eventuality.
Well, why
like
aren't
that.
They doing what Henry suggests?
I think that's fascinating what he suggested. And because I've seen them actually, BP, draw out this riser. Is this huge, you know, it was 5,000-foot-long pipe. And when the whole rig collapsed, it wound up into this big spaghetti noodle all over the place where it is broken in some places. So they've been trying to fix all these various places where it's broken. He makes a very good point that to cut and sort of start afresh, maybe they're just afraid to do that. I don't know why.
Scott?
Well,
no, let me explain. The industry is built on pipes or tubes. We can handle anything that's a cylinder. We can't handle boxes. If we got in there with what's called a casing cutter, it's a device that cuts a piece of pipe in seconds. It's done all the time in pipelines, in well drilling, in you name it. They can do this and have one nice, clean cut that's available for any device they want to put on top of it, a secondary blowout preventer, or even just a valve which can connect to the surface.
Okay.
It's really very easy.
All right. Henry, I'm going to ask Dorianne Espin to put you on hold. I want Jonathan Smith to get a number from you, and I want Neil King to talk to you after the program.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Now, let's go to Mike here in Washington, D.C. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. This is Mike. So my question is, given that this is just an unprecedented oil spill, I mean, it's about as large as the Exxon Valdez was 20 years ago. You know, there are plans by this administration. Somebody referenced it, one of your guests, that about a month ago, President Obama suggested that he wanted to move offshore drilling into new areas off the Atlantic coast and off the Alaska coast and close to the west coast of Florida. And now we have yesterday a proposal from two senators in the climate bill to actually give an incentive to states to allow drilling very close to their shores, kind of like the area or the well off Louisiana. I just don't understand why, given this huge spill, why would we be wanting to go down those paths? Why would we want to spread drilling to new places around the country where we could have spills like this?
Scott.
Well, it's a valid question. I would say to allay the listener's concern, I mean, we're not going to be rushing headlong into a lot more new plays and new developments for a while the inquiry continues as far as the appropriate approaches to respond to it. I would say that the bill that was introduced yesterday has a balanced approach as it comes to offshore drilling. While it does allow for what's called revenue sharing for those coastal states and put some money into land and water conservation funds as well that would be at the disposal of those states, it also allows the state legislature to opt out of the program and up to a distance of 75 miles off their coast. Remember, the Deepwater Horizon was only about 42 miles off of the Louisiana coast, so that's actually quite a long.
But how much pressure might there be from the oil companies themselves?
Well, look, let me just say we've talked about a lot of parties here that are potentially at fault or aren't doing things as smart. We've left one party out, which is we the people. We put a tremendous amount of demand on reliable and affordable supplies of hydrocarbons, particularly to go into our automobiles. We do not flock in great numbers toward electric automobiles, and you can't just say it's because the government didn't give you a tax credit. There's a lot of reasons for it, a lot of things in the American psyche and our commitment to automobility and the rest of it. So we, too, have to change the way we do our business.
Scott Siegel, Bracewell, Giuliani, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Ed who says, I'm wondering what efforts are being made to determine if the same mistakes that were made with the Deepwater Horizon have been made with other rigs. With the finger-pointing, corner-cutting, and relaxed regulations, is there a threat this will happen again with another rig or offshore oil well, Joe?
Well, I think the short answer is we don't know, because the rigs basically self-certify. The blowout preventers and other key pieces of equipment. My guess is that all of the major producers are now double-checking their equipment. But I think fundamentally, until we figure out exactly what happened, it's going to be very hard to know how to prevent it.
Here's another question. How deep was BP really drilling? Greg Palast, investigative reporter, claims they were drilling deeper than the allowed 18,000 feet and failed to communicate this to Halliburton, which in turn failed to adjust the composition of cement. Neil King.
Yeah, that's an interesting coda to that question, because that brings up a whole different issue. There is this suggestion out there, which has been unanswered and should be pushed on more, about whether they did exceed their depth. I don't know if there is a definitive answer to that at the moment. There's also the question, which I think is equally interesting, which he sort of touches on, and that is when the drill itself got into the field itself, did they find a field that actually presented various challenges to them that they weren't really well prepared to address? And when you were talking earlier about these burps or hiccups or whatever that had occurred 2 weeks before, whether they basically punctured into this field and they found that there was pressure that they weren't ready to deal with, maybe even a heat. You know, the thing is, this oil is hot when it's down at that depth, and it's under incredible pressure. And in the end, were they scrambling to deal with something they weren't prepared for, which also caused problems with the blowout preventer, which et cetera, et cetera. And maybe that would also be explained by the fact that they might have gone a little deeper than they were planning.
Right. A word on the depth for a moment. There's no doubt that there's different physical environment when you're going deeper and deeper. However, this raises a valid point about Congress's and the regulatory agency's response to what went on. If we develop, they say sometimes that bad facts make bad law. We shouldn't necessarily have a one-size-fits-all regime, because, for example, shallow water drilling, also off the coast, does not face these same issues. In fact, it's largely natural gas and not oil, so it doesn't have as much of a slick possibility. And that natural gas is absolutely needed for transition to the clean energy economy. So I guess what I would say is about throwing out babies with bathwaters is that while there may be some focus that needs to be brought to very, very deep water exploration, we don't want to make it so difficult to do shallow water that we sequester a lot of natural gas that we need for clean energy use in this country.
Joe, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, I think the bottom line is, in the short term, we need much stronger. We have to need to figure out what happened and put in place much stronger mandatory regulations, not voluntary. And in long term, we need to pass a clean energy and climate bill that finally makes a transition to getting us off of fossil fuels and onto clean energy.
And with this bill, how much more or less likely is it that we're going to get this climate legislation?
Well, I think it's an uphill battle to get 60 votes in the Senate for anything. I do think that if President Obama put the kind of push behind it that he gave to his health care bill, then we could, in fact, pass a strong climate and clean energy bill.
Do you think?
I don't know. I thought there was a funny statement that Senator Kerry made yesterday where he said, good policy is good politics, which to me showed that maybe he's not that great a politician. because there's great policy out there on this front. A gas tax is great policy, but is it great politics? No, it's terrible politics.
Neil King at the Wall Street Journal, Joe Rome, he's at the Center for American Progress. His blog is climateprogress.org. He's the author of Straight Up, America's Fiercest Climate Blogger, takes on the status quo media politicians and clean energy solutions. And Scott Siegel, Bracewell Giuliani. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.